You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Thank you for coming to this session. My name is Michael Cooper. I have a long history in missions. I've been involved in missions now for nearly 40 years. I know I don't look that old, and I don't feel like I'm that old, but I started very young, right out of college. I went to the mission field and have had a very interesting and diverse career doing work with Crew now. Back in the day, it was Campus Crusade in Eastern Europe in the Soviet Union, and then with the Evangelical Free Church in the country of Romania for 10 years. We were a part of church planting there. And then I got involved in academics. And I loved the wedding of the two, missions and academics. So I am by training a missiologist. I did my graduate work at Columbia International University and then my PhD at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. And then I got stuck at Trinity and taught there for 10 years, and which was a great experience. My research kind of that kept me there in some manner. I was at the time. This isn't what I was planning on talking about. But anyway, I'll just to sum this up. My research was on new religious movements, and specifically, I focused on the Druids. If you remember the ancient Druids, well, there's a contemporary manifestation of them, and so that research took me to very interesting places, where I began to grow an interest in archaeology. I did some work at Stonehenge, not archaeological work, but I did some research at Stonehenge, actually discovered a Stone Age arrowhead while I was there. And I tried to take it to the British Museum. I'm saying this as a point of confession. I felt like this might cleanse my soul, but they wouldn't see me. And so I took it. I have it at home. And I authenticated it. It's a Stone Age arrowhead that I found at Stonehenge. So anyway, I'm fascinated with archaeology for many reasons that will become clear in this presentation. So, but I'm also fascinated with space, architectural space. My undergraduate degree is in architecture, and I've always loved thinking about how do we effectively utilize space, and especially as we're thinking about missions. So combining all of those things, missiology, architecture, archaeology, has kind of brought me to this point today. Well, not, I guess it's brought me to this point. I've been working on this for a little bit now, but brings us to today and today's presentation, where I'm going to try to intersect all of these together, because it's very fascinating to think about the archaeological implications for missions and what the archaeological record shows us about missions in the first centuries and what we can learn for missions today. And so I'm excited to be able to share this with you. This is, of course, the second time I've done this presentation. This is the first time this material has been presented. It's going into a book, Lord willing, as a part of my research interest in missiology and archaeology. I just think there's a gap in our academic understanding of the New Testament, and especially of missions, if we don't consider archaeology. And so I have a number of pictures that I'm going to show you that will kind of demonstrate these things. So bear with me. You all are the second group of guinea pigs for this presentation. I will talk about Ephesus. I have a passion for Ephesus. That is, I believe, the most important church in the New Testament, without question. That's me, though. I wrote a book on it, so I have to say that, don't I? But I think it's true. I think that church has influenced early Christianity like no other church. And it continues at some level to influence us today, not only because of the biblical literature that we have in regards to that city, but also extra-biblical literature that we have in regards to that city, the letters of Ignatius, for example, to Ephesus, as well as the council that was held there that was very important. So we're going to definitely talk about Ephesus, but we're going to also talk a bit about Corinth and Athens and these very important cities where we'll get a deeper, richer picture of what was happening there by looking at some of the archaeological record. Okay? Are you with me so far? I'm going to try to do this by answering this question. How did they hear? And notice this is the past tense, right? How did they hear? Because we in some way want to wrap our minds around what it was that they were doing then that might help us in what we do today. And so by asking this question, I'm going to try to, I'm going to ask more questions. I'm going to ask first, who heard? This is an easy question. We'll kind of zip through this with just a small caveat for some context. Where did they hear it? This will be a little bit more complex of a question because we're going to get into some of the geeky kind of academic stuff that I enjoy. You probably won't enjoy it, but I'll enjoy sharing it with you. And so bear with me through that part. And then what did they hear? And this is going to get a little, maybe, I don't know if it's any more geeky, if that's possible, but we're going to get a little bit more geeky on this too, because we're looking at the archaeological record and how it helps to enliven the biblical record. And then ultimately, we're going to conclude with, how does this apply for today? Now, my wife told me yesterday, as she said in this session, that I should start with some more reference points to what it is that I'm hoping to conclude with by the end of this presentation. So these are just minor points. So how does this apply? Well, it's going to show us that it is very important for us to study academically. I know there is a propensity, especially among some evangelical groups, to poo-poo. That's a very theologically technical term, to poo-poo academics. But we cannot do that, and nor do we have any example of anybody in the New Testament saying no to academics. In fact, what we do have are the testimonies of the early writers saying how important this is. We're going to look at first contact points in a community. And here is where we're going to get into some technical language things so that we can better wrap our minds around what it was that was going on, especially in Paul's second and third missionary journeys. We're going to talk about a place of peace, but don't be confused by this reference, because this place of peace will turn out to be a place of obstinance as well, because there were places where Paul engaged that in the beginning, these were positive experiences. Many people came to Christ, but they ended up turning out to be places where people, in some cases, violently rebelled against what Paul was doing. We're going to talk about the importance of indigenous space. Not creating new space, but looking for existing space where we should be engaging. And then finally, the clear declaration that we are to profess as we're in these spaces. So let me begin. I mentioned already that archaeology is important to the understanding of the biblical text. William Ramsey, who I'm sure you all have heard of, he was a renowned New Testament scholar, self-trained really in New Testament studies, an archaeologist as well, but also self-trained. He was a Roman Latin scholar by training, but he also ultimately became an apologist. And it's largely Ramsey that we have to thank for our understandings of Luke and Acts and how much of a historian Luke was and why that was important. And he determined that because of his work in Asia Minor, looking at especially the seven churches, but other areas of Asia Minor that connected with the book of Acts. His conclusion was, there is no way that we could ever think anything other than Luke being a great historian because of the accuracy that was discovered in the archaeological record that coincides with the New Testament record. And so he says this, if we want to understand the ancients, especially the Greeks, we must breathe the same air as they did and saturate ourselves with the same scenery and the same nature that shaped them. What he's basically suggesting is we all should be going to Asia Minor and to Palestine and looking at these spaces. And if you've been on trips to any of these areas or any other ancient places, you really get a sense of what people had experienced. Now, it's not an accurate sense, but it just comes alive in a different way. Have you all been to Asia Minor, Israel, some of you? Okay. Other places. I did that with my research at Stonehenge. When I first began that research, or on one research trip I took, I wanted to have the full experience. And so I walked from Woodhenge to Stonehenge because there's a path that people would travel just to have the experience, to see what it was they would see, to feel the air that they would feel, to smell the things that they would smell, and so forth. And it brings a different perspective to what it is that you will experience when you actually are there. So let's begin with the first question. Like I said, this is an easy one. Who heard? Well, we know the Jews heard, right? But here's what's, I think, important for us, because we sometimes miss this point in the New Testament, that the Jews were not a monolithic ethnic group. Okay? In fact, what we know about Judaism up through the Hasmonean dynasty into the New Testament time was that there were a lot of converts to Judaism, Greek, Roman, other ethnicities that converted to Judaism. And so when we talk about the Jews, we can't think of them as some monolithic group, but a very diverse ethnic population. We heard yesterday, for example, Dr. Garrison talk about Simon of Cyrene from Libya. Most likely he was dark-complected, as was John Mark, also from Libya, and his family, who we meet in the book of Acts, where the early church met in the house of Mary, the mother of John Mark. So here we have Libyan Jews, most likely converts at some point. Judaism also was very different in the first century than it was in the time of the Old Testament. We have the emergence of rabbis, the emergence of synagogues, and we're going to get into more detail about these things. And so it's important for us to keep in mind that as this scholar of the history of Israel writes, from the time of the Hasmoneans in the second century BC, Judaism was clearly a proselytizing monotheism that experienced rapid expansion within the Hellenistic world. Now, this is exciting because this is the context in which the early church grows. Here you already have this understanding of monotheism that's being expressed in Judaism, people converting to that. And so when Christianity comes along and begins to proclaim Jesus as God, then you see a tremendous shift in these converts to Judaism into Christianity. And this is a sociological phenomenon, really, because we see this even in Islam. When Islam begins to invade, there's a conversion of Jews to Islam, as well as Christians to Islam. But that's another topic. So the Jews, we know the Jews heard, both ethnically Hebrews as well as converts to Judaism. And we know the Gentiles, right? They heard, the God-fearers. In the New Testament, they're referred to as sebomeno, ton theon, God-fearers or worshipers of God. We see like in Acts 16:14, 18:4. And then pagans, of course, Gentiles. And just as we think about the Jews as not a monolithic ethnic group, we should also keep in mind that the Gentiles are not a monolithic ethnic group either. There's not one group called the Gentiles. It's just kind of a name that we would, for example, use in the United States, Americans. Americans are made up of many different ethnic groups. The same in the context of the first century. The Gentiles are made up of many ethnic groups. In fact, in and around the area of Ephesus, in Asia Minor, there are more than 50 distinct ethnic groups that we can document. And I talk a bit about that in the book, Ephesiology. And so it's a very diverse group in which Paul and others have engaged with the gospel. So who heard? But where did they hear? Well, we know that in many cases, the first place they heard was at the synagogue, synagogos, or synagoge in Greek. We're going to come back to this because there's a secret about this word that you might not know, and I'm going to share it with you. Another word that is used in the New Testament is archisynagogos, or a ruler of a synagogue, and that's a word that we're going to come back and unpack a little bit more here in a bit. But we know that Paul and others went to the marketplace. We see this in Athens. We see this in many places where Paul will engage with people in dialogue. Here's a picture of the market in Athens. This is the Roman Agora. If you've been to Athens, you've no doubt seen this. In Corinth as well, another area that's called the Agora. Most likely, Paul and Aquila and Priscilla would have sold their leather works in this area. There's another agora on the other side of the city of Corinth that we'll talk about because that one is very interesting, but could be there that they sold their works. And you can imagine on these streets, in these shops, Priscilla, Aquila, Paul, and others are sharing the gospel with other people. This is the what's called the Tetragonos Agora in Ephesus, a huge agora. Here you can see the Library of Celsus, which was not there when Paul was there. This is a 3rd century building. But the agora is all this area. And then back over in here, it stretches out all the way to the harbor. And we'll look at another picture of that as well. But just get the sense of these are the places where people are being engaged with the gospel. The philosophical schools, we know that Paul engaged the philosophers, for example, in Athens at the Acropolis, at the Areopagus. This is a picture looking at the Acropolis from the Areopagus, and another one looking at the Stoa, the Attalus from the Areopagus. And so we know Paul engaged philosophers in Acts 17 at this location. But there were other places as well that were schools of philosophy. We think perhaps the school or the Hall of Tyrannus was one of those places. This might be a place similar to a Hall of Tyrannus. It is definitely a hall. We call this an apsidal hall. This is in Ephesus among the terrace houses. In Ephesus. This is the outline of it here. You see the apse here. These halls were sort of a trademark, if you will, of the wealthy person in a city. They would be used for receptions of people. Maybe their workers would come and be asking for favors from the patron. Sometimes they would be used for dining halls, and they would entertain guests there. But occasionally, they would also be used for lecture halls. And it might be a place like this where Paul was giving his lectures at the Hall of Tyrannus. We don't know. There's a lot in archaeology that we don't know. We can't settle on some of these things. In fact, we're not exactly certain whose house this was, although there's an inscription. There's another column base here that gives us a person's name of Gaius. It might have been his home. But it talks about this beautiful home here. Here's another example of a hall, an apsidal hall. This is in Laodicea. This is just to give you a picture of a place where Paul or some of the other disciples might have gathered together with others to give talks, to have discipleship, to have dialogue and reasoning together. This actually, we believe, is a 2nd century house church. In Laodicea. Do you remember Laodicea? This is what's so fascinating about the archaeological record, because unless we understand how Christianity grew in that city, we're left with the impression that this is the church that Jesus wanted to spew out of his mouth, right? From Revelation chapter 3. But in fact, by the 4th century in Laodicea, not only was the church meeting in a hall like this, which would easily hold 100, 150 people, they ultimately began to meet in a theater that held 12,000 people. We suspect this. And the reason why we suspect this, we were just there not too long ago, and the archaeologists took us back to a pile of columns, capitals, near the North Theater, the smaller of the two that are in Laodicea. He said, "You want to see something kind of cool? We haven't shown anybody this. It has not been published yet." He said, "Don't take a picture." Oh, maybe I shouldn't talk about this. It doesn't matter. I've written about it already. Anyway, he said, "Come look at this." And so we went back to look at these column capitals that had been excavated from the theater in Laodicea, and they had crosses on them. And they believed that the Christians used the theater as a place to gather. Can you imagine? Laodicea. Jesus warns them of their complacency, and yet they took that warning and turns it around. And nearly a huge part of the population of that city ultimately comes to Christ. So that Paul and others also use political spaces. We have numbers of references of Paul's to politics, Romans 13, for example, 1 Timothy 2. The sports arena as well. Do you remember 1 Timothy, the chapter 4, verse 8? The bodily discipline is of some benefit, but spiritual discipline of better benefit. You remember? And you can picture in this a place where he might have been saying things like this. This is the Bulletarian in Ephesus. Most likely, Paul would have met the Asiarchs here. And other politicians. The town clerk that we read about in Acts chapter 19. Whoa, wait, there's not, you didn't even tell me there wasn't a picture. I did this yesterday. My wife was telling me that I was talking about things that weren't on the screen. So if I say something that's not on the screen, somebody call my attention to it. But this is the Bulletarian. Paul would have met the Asiarchs here. The town clerk would have conducted his business here. And from this place, most likely, he would have gone to the theater during that riot. But these are the places where the early disciples were walking and ministering. In reference to the sports arena, this is a part of the gymnasium complex in Ephesus. It's a huge complex. And we have literary records that this place was also used for schools. The halls in these would be used for teaching. Sometimes they would be used for philosophical schools. So it could be that the Hall of Tyrannus was in one of these places at the sports arena. And so you get this idea. Here, Paul is using sports imaging. And we sometimes will ask, well, why does he do that? Well, here's why. This was a place of teaching and of bodily discipline, right? Oh, no, this. Oh, this is huge. I am. Yeah, no, it would be way above our heads. Yeah, this is. I've taken this picture standing on a step about, and I did use the telephoto lens. And I am probably at least a quarter of a mile away from this. It's a huge stadium, gymnasium complex. And so all of this brings me to the conclusion that Paul reasoned with people in the natural spaces where people gathered. That is, Paul placed himself in the proximity of people. He didn't create the space. He didn't say, hey, I'm going to build this building. Now come and listen to me talk. He went to where the space was already created. And we're going to come back to this point in our conclusion. So where did they hear? Now, let me take a little, not a caveat, but this is really a geeky part of what we're going to talk about in regards to the synagogue. Because this is so fascinating. To be honest, this is a recent understanding of mine. When I wrote the book Ephesiology and I began to do research on ways in which the church adapted forms, I mean, I've known this back from my seminary days, that the church did adapt the synagogue form, but I didn't really understand what that word meant. And so as I was reading some ancient literature for the book Ephesiology, I came across some very interesting references to synagogue that just kind of blew my mind, honestly. I thought, what? How did I not know this? How come we aren't talking about this? And so that's what I'm going to talk about here. So there's a long traditional view, of course, that Paul did go to synagogues as a first point of contact on his missionary journeys. There's no doubt about this. We see it in nearly every place he goes. He goes to a synagogue. What's interesting is that synagogue was not the most popular word for a Jewish place of worship. The more popular word, and we see this in Philo's writings, Philo of Alexandria, he uses the word house of prayer instead of synagogue. He does use synagogue, but house of prayer is his preferred word as a place of worship for the Jews. Now, we find this word in Acts chapter 16, 14, right? You remember? Paul's in Philippi. He and his gang go out. Gang, that doesn't sound nice. He and his group of really cool people go out to find a place of prayer, the New Testament tells us. I learned in seminary that that was because there wasn't a synagogue, that instead they would go to a house, a place of prayer, and it was usually located by a water source. But I've come to the conclusion that that's not the case at all. I think there was a synagogue in Philippi. And otherwise, it makes no sense whatsoever that when Paul writes to the Philippians that he describes himself as a Pharisee. Why would he do that? There's a definite Jewish population in Philippi, and they had a definite place of worship, and they called that place of worship the house of prayer. And there is where, of course, we meet Lydia and her group of business people. Now, the literary record is clear that there are many synagogues all throughout the ancient world. Stephen Fine and his research has uncovered 150 literary references to Jewish synagogues in the diaspora of Judaism. So all over the Roman Empire, 150 synagogues in the literary record have been discovered. Okay, so that's, keep that in mind, not the archaeological record. Now, Mark Wilson claims that 60 of those are in Asia Minor and Greece, and he enumerates where some of those are. He says, in Asia Minor, synagogues have been identified at three sites. Three sites. This is the archaeological record. Now, we have very little evidence, archaeological evidence, that synagogues actually existed in the form of a building. And that's important for us to understand because the early the Jews didn't always gather in a building that was a dedicated synagogue. Sometimes they gathered in people's homes. And it's the word synagoge that means to assemble, to bring together. That the New Testament uses this word as well in James chapter 2, verse 2, when he's talking about when you assemble together and somebody goes up to the front, you remember? That word is synagoge. The Hebrew writer uses a cognate of that word in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24, when he says, do not forsake the gathering together, the episynagoge, the gathering together. And so it has a diverse range that Christians used as well as Jews used to mean gathering together, not necessarily a building. So it's at times disappointing that we don't have an archaeological record of synagogues. We do have some, as Wilson points out, but we don't have a lot. Now, while there's no denying that Paul's mission to the Jews provided a natural inroad to his missionary strategy for reaching metropolises, it also misunderstands the meaning of synagogue, much in the same way that ecclesia is misunderstood today. When we say ecclesia or church today, we often think of it as a building, don't we? The same with synagogue. When you think of a synagogue, you're thinking of a building. You're not thinking of a gathering. But, and this is what's interesting, even the Jews, I might be lying and I don't like doing that, but there are records of Jews using the word ecclesia as their gathering, just as they would use the word synagogue, for their gathering. All right, so the epigraphical record testifies to something that's often overlooked about this word, okay? Are you ready for it? You might already know this. I've been so impressed with Dwell Community Church and what you all do, so I won't be surprised if you know this already. Synagoge is not a Hebrew word. It's a Greek word, and it has a Greek meaning to it. And so let me give you some examples of ways in which this has been used over the history of the word. My first encounter with the word was in a 5th century document, 5th century BC document. And do you know what that document was about? The life of Pythagoras, the 5th century BC philosopher. You know where his disciples met? In a synagogue, synagogue. Now, when I first read that, I thought, what, you mean Pythagoras is a Jew? Well, no, he's not a Jew. He's Greek, but that's just the word. They gathered together in a synagogue. Here are some other references that will probably surprise you. One, this is a fascinating three panels that were discovered in Asia Minor that depicts a scene of the worship of Zeus and a banquet in his honor. And so you get in this more of an understanding of what happened in these celebrations, these banquets that would often take place in the first century. So, and this is the translation. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I don't have a picture of this. Sorry. Just the words. On the panel is inscribed what's written here. And what I want to point out, instead of reading all of this, is that in the description, we read that they announced this in the synagogue of who? Zeus. The synagogue of Zeus. Isn't that interesting? I mean, I find it interesting that here we're seeing the word extending its range, its lexical range of meaning, from just our understanding of it being something Jewish to now it's encompassing something that is certainly pagan, the synagogue of Zeus. But not only was it used in terms of a gathering place for a pagan worship of a god or goddess, it was also used to indicate a place of work. And so we have this example on another panel that is about the synagogue of small wares dealers. And so now the range of the meaning of synagogue has been extended to not only a place of Jewish worship, but also a trade guild. And we have numerous references to the synagogue as a trade guild. For example, this one, the synagogue of the barbers. Did you know the barbers had a guild? Isn't that interesting? And this particular guild of barbers also had an archisynagogos. In the New Testament, this is translated the ruler of the synagogue. But so we have they gathered around this guy's house, the archisynagogos. So the range of the meaning of archisynagogos now is extended from not only just a ruler of a synagogue, of a Jewish place of worship, but also the master of a trade guild. And so now I think you're beginning to get the picture here, that the word has quite a range. And here is one more reference. In the writings of Diogenes, in his Lives of the Philosophers, writes about Pyrrho, a 2nd century BC philosopher, who meets in a synagogue. His disciples are gathering together in a synagogue. So now we have that range of meaning of synagogue extending from not only a Jewish place of worship, a pagan place of worship, a trade guild, to a philosophical school, a place where education occurred. And so there's quite a range of meaning. And this draws some scholars, like my colleague Ralph Korner, to declare this. It has become clear that synagogue is an ethnically neutral term that is used for group modalities of non-Judean and Judean associations and non-Judean and Judean communities of Christos followers. And so there's quite a range to the meaning of this word. Now, this is just simply, again, articulating that range. What we see for this word, it's a Jewish place of worship of Yahweh. It's a Christian gathering. Sometimes they did this together. Jews and Christians sometimes met together in the same gathering space. We see this, for example, in Acts chapter 9, where Paul was going to the synagogues to take out the Jews, to take out the Christians and to persecute them. It's a pagan gathering of worship of Greek and Roman gods and goddesses. It's an occupational or vocational association like a trade guild or a collegia, and it's a philosophical school. So it has that range of meaning. And similarly, like the synagogue, the archisynagogos has the meaning of a ruler of a synagogue or the master of a trade guild. So this creates quite the conundrum for the Bible student of the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts. And it presents some reasons why I'm losing my hair. What does this mean then? How might this help us to understand what was happening in the New Testament? And what does that mean then for us today? Well, these are some of the conclusions that I'm making. One is that when in Acts, the context for synagogue refers to explicitly the synagogue of the Jews, and there are several cases where it's explicit, the synagogue of the Jews, then it's clearly referring to a gathering of the Jews for religious purposes. When the word is used in conjunction with a gathering on the Sabbath, it's also fairly certain that this is talking about a place of Jewish worship, except perhaps in one instance, and I'll get to that, in the city of Corinth, where in terms of trade guilds, where the word feels more ambiguous is in the context where there's no indication of any sort of Jewish worship, no reading of the Torah, no prayer, and so on. And so it might not be a place of Jewish worship. In these contexts, there are references to a marketplace or trades, like we see in Athens, Corinth, and Ephesus, for example. So what I am not saying, and I do not want you to hear me say this, I'm not saying that there were no Jews in Asia Minor. There were. We have extensive literary epigraphic attestation to Jews being in Asia Minor. What I'm saying is that the references in the New Testament might not always refer to a Jewish place of worship. They might refer to something else, and we need to keep this in mind. So let me show you a couple pictures here. These are from Corinth. This first one, this one's interesting, but it's 6th century AD, so I'm not all that interested in it. This one's 3rd century AD. I'm more interested in this, because it's closer to the time period. But this is a lintel block that was discovered on one of the roads coming into the city of Corinth. And on the lintel block, you can see some letters here. Do you see those? Gamma, omega, gamma, eta, epsilon, beta, rho. These are the words that ultimately we think spell synagoge Hebraeon, the synagogue of the Hebrews. Okay? So what's interesting about this is where it was found. Okay, now these things, they're not light blocks. I mean, these are heavy marble blocks. And so more than likely where it fell is very close to where it had been erected in the first place. So this was on the road coming into the city of Corinth where shops were lined on both sides. And guilds would meet, they would sell their wares and whatever along that road. So most likely that this is marking the place of a trade guild of Hebrews that were working in the city of Corinth. Now, that does not mean that there wasn't another place where they gathered to worship. There most certainly was. But in terms of the archaeological record and what that might help us to understand about Paul's ministry in Corinth, it certainly opens a door of opportunity to say that, well, maybe Paul actually was going to a guild and not a Jewish place of worship when he is in Corinth. And why do I say that? Well, the text is very interesting because it makes reference to five other people. Priscilla and Aquila, right? They are of the same trade, right? In Greek, it's homotechne, which literally translates trade guild, not same trade. That's kind of a wooden English translation of it because of homo being the same and techno being trade. The word in Greek means trade guild. So they were members of the same trade guild, Priscilla and Aquila and the Apostle Paul. He was a member. I don't know if he carried a card membership or whatever, but he was a member of this trade guild. And then the scene continues and we meet Crispus, remember? And who is he? It's translated synagogue ruler, archisynagogos. And then Sosthenes, also a synagogue ruler, right? Two synagogue rulers. What's interesting about Crispus is his name is Latin. It could be that he was a convert, a Latin convert to Judaism, and he was the ruler of a Jewish place of worship. That's a possibility. and I leave that open. But it's also possible that he might have been the master of one of these trade guilds as well. Sosthenes, however, that's a Greek name, I'm almost certain he was the master of a trade guild, and this is why. Because Sosthenes is present when Paul stands before Gallio, remember? And the Jews kind of bring all these accusations against Paul, and Gallio says, you know, I don't want anything to do with your Jewish stuff. There were some tensions going on between Rome and the Jews, we know. And then what happens? The Jews start doing what? They beat up Sosthenes. Can you imagine the Jews beating up their own ruler? Their own leader of the synagogue? No, it just makes no sense whatsoever. Now, we know ultimately Sosthenes converts to Christianity because he co-authors 1 Corinthians with Paul. But most likely, he's a trade guild leader. And that's probably why Gallio could care less. The Romans weren't all that excited about trade guilds because trade guilds often presented political rivals and could potentially create instability. And we see this in Ephesus, remember? The riot that almost occurs, that's led by trade guild leaders. All right, are we getting a kind of a picture here? All right, this is Ephesus. You recognize the Library of Celsus. Again, it's a fascinating building. Beautiful to see, was not there when Paul was there. This, you can barely see, is at what we call a graffiti, of a menorah on a step up to the library. This is most certainly earlier than this. This is what we call spolia, where they would take things from other buildings and use it for newer buildings. That's most likely what this is. So this is evidence that there were certainly Jews in Ephesus, but look how crude it is. I mean, it's just a crude carving in a marble step. That might not have been a step originally, but it's certainly crude. And that raises a question in terms of, it raises a number of questions, because when we do have references, archaeological references to synagogues, and we see that, they're elaborate, they're beautiful. The mosaics in them, the artwork, they're just beautiful. They're not crude like what we see here. This is another menorah here. This is in Laodicea. That's hard to see, isn't it? Can you see it? Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's better if you stand back. Yeah. So you see the menorah. There's a shofar and a palm branch here. Then there's a cross here that's been carved above it. Some scholars have said that this is a defacing of Judaism, an early example of Jewish anti-Semitism on the part of Christians. I think, though, that it's really expressing that Christianity is coming out of Judaism, that Christianity is the center point. Christ is the center point here. So all of that to say that, yes, there are certainly Jews, and they are so important to early Christianity because they provided places where they gathered together, the Jews and Christians. They provided a continuity as well in terms of religious identity and so on. So, but I draw this conclusion. It is noteworthy that we have very little textual evidence that synagogue in Athens, Corinth, and Ephesus had any distinctly religious affiliation. Luke does not mention, and this is important, does not mention prayer, reading of the Torah, meeting on the Sabbath, except for Corinth, nor does he indicate that Paul, as a Pharisee, had a place to sit. Do you remember references on his first missionary journey when they would go into a synagogue? They would sit down. And then they would be invited to speak. And these other references, Paul's just going to a synagogue, and that's why I believe it's a trade guild, like in Corinth and in Ephesus, and he's talking. He's reasoning with people. He's not invited. He's just engaging people in those places. So they could very well be synagogue where Jews gathered, but more likely these synagogi, the plural, were Jewish trade guilds. So that's where did they hear? Yes. Yeah, you know, some people compare it to like a union today, but I think it's more of a, like, our son's an engineer, and so he's a member of an engineering guild, so to speak. So a guild of people who all share the same occupation. Yeah. I don't think it was like a, well, it could be, but I mean, that's reading our stuff back into the New Testament. But what did they hear? Let me, and I'm, this is where we're going to wrap up. So I'm going to do this really fast, but this is a cool part. We know they dialogued, dialegomai, reasoning is what the word is in Greek, dialegomai. They reasoned from Scripture. Usually this is in reference to their reasoning with Jews. They would use the word graphe. They reasoned about the kingdom of God. And this is one of the reasons why in Ephesus, for example, I'm more comfortable in saying that that was a trade guild in Ephesus and not a synagogue, because the Jews did not need to be convinced about the kingdom of God. They knew about this. The Greeks, however, did, especially the Ephesians, because they had all kinds of experiences with kingdoms. And then they used the word, the logos. And we see this word in Acts 18:11, but 19, 10, and 20 in Ephesus. And the logos here is important. And my wife said I should actually say something about this because it's interesting. So forgive me. The logos, I mean, it is fascinating because the word, we meet it in the writings of a 6th century BC philosopher from the city of Ephesus. His name is Heraclitus. And Heraclitus wrote a book called On Nature. And it's really a fascinating book. We don't have it. We have fragments of it. But after he wrote it, he put it in the Temple of Artemis so that anybody coming to Ephesus could read his philosophy. So he was very well known, very renowned philosopher from Ephesus. And in his book, he begins to articulate the Logos philosophy. And what he says about the Logos is that from the Logos comes everything. We actually, Sam made a reference to Heraclitus today about the river. You know, you never step in the same river twice. That's Heraclitus. But in this Logos thing, he's articulating that from Logos becomes everything. Comes everything. And so when Paul is there and Luke says that the word of the Lord spread to every resident, it's the Logos. And he says it twice, the Logos. And you see what he's doing is connecting the Logos of Heraclitus to the Logos that is Christ. We know the Apostle John, when he goes to Ephesus, probably during the Jewish wars, he is asked by the leaders in the churches in Ephesus to write the story about Jesus. We know this from Jerome. And he says no. Can you imagine him saying no? But he does. He says no. So they beg him, they implore him, please, we don't have the story about the Savior. And so they wanted it desperately. So John said to them, if you pray and fast, then I will write the story of Jesus. And so they prayed and fasted. And Jerome tells us that when they broke the fast, John began to write, in the beginning was the Logos. And the Logos was God. Do you see what he's doing? He's saying what you Ephesians have believed for 600 years about the Logos being, from the Logos comes everything. I am declaring to you explicitly, this is Jesus Christ. That is super cool. All right, now I really have to speed up. All right, does anybody know what this is? Now, who was in Ephesus? Somebody was in Ephesus. You no doubt saw this. You didn't see it. Oh my goodness, they're everywhere in Ephesus. This is what's called a Christogram. It's an 8-spoked wheel, and it stands for Jesus Christ God, the Yoda Chi Theta here. Jesus Christ God. It was a symbol that early Christians used to indicate that they were Christians, or this was a place of Christians. And so we see this everywhere. See if you can find it here. Do you see it? Okay, now, do you know what this building is? This is a synagogue. At least they claim it's a synagogue. There are some of us, a couple of us at least, that are saying, you know what? Yes, Jews could have met here, and there's no doubt because we know that there have been menorah, there are Jewish mosaics there, but there are also Christian items there. Not the least of which is this, but some others on the interior, like this, there's a, you can't see it, but anyway, it's not important. But here's a place marking perhaps a gathering of Christians. This particular building, this is in Sardis, can seat 1,000 people. And I think it probably had multi-purposes. It was a synagogue, probably a place of Christian gathering. Maybe Jews and Christians gathered together, but it was also probably a place of a trade guild. Because on this side of the synagogue, synagogue or building, are trade shops. Jews, Christians, pagans were all right on the same street selling their wares. Do you see this one? All right, this one's cool. Do you know where this one was? It was here. Do you remember seeing that picture a moment ago? Perhaps a second century house church in Laodicea. Anybody remember Ephesians? Anybody remember Revelation 3:20? Tell me what that says. Say it so everybody can hear. Who stands at the door? Jesus Christ, God. This is at the entrance of this house church in Laodicea. Would that not be a cool reminder that, wow, we need to remember what Jesus said? Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anybody hears my voice and opens the door, I'll come in and dine with him and he with me. I think that's really cool. All right, so this is the theater in Ephesus. I remember why I put that in there. Because from here is Harbor Road this way. There's another road that goes up this way to the library, and then another road that goes up this way. On this road, going to the harbor, here you can see the road going to the harbor and back to the theater. There are a dozen of these Christograms on the road. And I wonder if they are testifying to places where Christians were in business, identifying a Christian shop, and perhaps even being used as a witness tool to tell people about Jesus Christ is God, not Artemis, Jesus. All right, one more, and I am just going to speed through this. This is what's called the Crypto Agora in Smyrna, the entrance. In that agora, there is all kinds of graffiti. Some of it is definitely pagan. There are a couple pieces that are Christian. This is one of them. You can't see it here, and so I've replicated it on this next sign, but this is called a word square. It's five words. It's the same word this way and this way, so horizontally and vertically all through it, and you can see it better here. Anybody know what that middle word is? Logos, all capital letters, in the form of a cross. This is clear indication that this is a Christian graffiti. Now, we know what the other words mean. Why they fit here, we don't exactly know. I'm playing with an idea that this might have been an early gospel presentation. Can you imagine people walking in the market, somebody saying, hey, let me show you this, while they're buying fruit or whatever? Jesus Christ, this is the word for fruit. This is the word for delight, a word for name, and the word for floating. So we've fallen in the garden by eating it's because of our own pleasures, but Christ covers that. It's his name only that we're saved. And then the floating, I don't know. Jesus walks on water, the floating of the Holy Spirit over I don't know.